Coming up on today's episode...
Medicine is not a good model for so-called mental health, because there isn't something really called mental health, that people are more or less unhappy. If somebody's got a broken leg, more or less everybody agrees it needs to be splinted. If somebody's got a broken heart, there's no consensus.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Disquieted Life with me, Emma Williams. In this podcast series, I'm drawing on my background in philosophy to explore the idea of mental health and how different writers, artists, and thinkers have approached and challenged the topic. Today, I'll be in conversation with psychoanalyst Adam Phillips about mental health and the ideas of Sigmund Freud. Adam's worked as principal child psychotherapist at Charing Cross Hospital in London. Today, he's one of Britain's leading psychoanalysts and essayists. He's written books that include Terrors and Experts, Going Sane, and Promises, Promises, Essays in Literature and Psychoanalysis. He's also the general editor of the new Penguin Modern Classics translations of the works of Sigmund Freud. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what led you into this kind of work.
When I was 17, I read Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And it seemed to me a thrilling and sort of exciting life. And I was then, age 17, interested in what I thought of as the depths, and so was Jung. I'd never met a psychoanalyst, I didn't know anything about it. So I then thought, this was a really interesting life. Other than that, I was interested in English literature, but I had no plan to be anything in particular. And then, when Winnicott was a British paediatrician and psychoanalyst, and he wrote a book called Playing in Reality, and I read it when it came out, and I had a tremendous feeling of affinity with this book. I felt as though, as one done as a sort of young person, that it was written sort of for me and possibly by me, and that I felt I really understood it. Now, I can't imagine what I actually did understand then, but anyway. And reading that book, it was as though the book came and collected me. And I then knew I wanted to be a child psychoanalyst. And so then I trained. In those days, there were three trainings. There was a Tavistock Clinic, which was Kleinian. There was what was then called the Hampstead Clinic, which was Anna Freudian. And then there was a third place called the ICP, the Institute of Child Psychology, which was eclectic. It had Jungians, Anna Freudians, Kleinians, etc. So I wanted to go there for that reason, because it was eclectic. And then I trained. I had a four-year training. I was lucky enough to have effectively an apprenticeship. I had a trainee post at the Middlesex Hospital in the Department of Child Psychiatry. So I worked in a hospital department. The training took 4 years, and then I worked at Guy's Hospital, what was called a school for maladjusted children then. They're not called that anymore for obvious reasons. But they were basically the children who were not in prison yet and couldn't stay in school. And then I worked in Camberwell Child Guidance Clinic for quite a long time. And then I worked, my final job was at Charing Cross Hospital, again in the Department of Child Psychiatry. And that was, obviously, it was the National Health Service, which meant that I saw anybody who came. And then when I went into private practice, which I did regretfully, and I only did it because the National Health Service was being taken over effectively by business people. So I could no longer do the work that I wanted to do. So I then came into private practice.
So you mentioned Jung and Winnicott, who are both prominent writers of psychoanalytic work. But the founder of psychoanalysis is Freud.
He became an influence, but later on. In other words, I read Winnicott before I read Freud. But when I did read Freud, I was very powerfully affected by it. I mean, what I was really interested in was literature, what was then called literature. And so for me, Freud was a writer, first and foremost, and a really interesting writer. So he definitely, my fantasy of who he was captured my imagination, in the sense of he seemed to me to be, and of course this might be very wishful, a very ordinary, nice, middle-class, then-middle-class Jewish man who happened to discover psychoanalysis. And so he had a very ordinary life, family life, but he did this remarkable work and this incredible writing. Freud made a lot of sense to me. And of course, when you read Freud, you understand where psychoanalysis comes from.
Could you tell us a bit about Freud and what he came up with then? So he was a doctor, wasn't he, originally?
Yes, he was originally a doctor, and he did some neurology, but he was a Darwinian biologist. I mean, that was sort of what he was interested in, who became interested in what were then called neuroses. And what he discovered over time was he began by doing hypnosis, as lots of doctors like him did, And then he discovered, partly by accident, that if you let people talk, they tell you what's wrong with them, so to speak. And they always tell you more than they intend to. So in a way, he invented, on the one hand, a way of listening, but also sort of a way of talking, so that he would suggest to his patients that they say whatever came into their minds. And of course, this is a very unusual thing to do, because obviously most talk is very heavily censored. So you go and see a psychoanalyst and you're encouraged to say whatever comes into your mind. And you're made aware by the analyst where you hesitate, where you pause, where you resist, where you lose your fluency. And Freud began to discover, well, two things, really. One was what he called infantile sexuality, which basically meant that children were sexual creatures. Not sexual in the way that adults are, but they're very sensually driven. And they have the childhood equivalent of sexual desires. He also discovered, along with this, that there was what he thought of as an unconscious mind. Now, of course, he didn't invent the idea of the unconscious. But he had, gradually over time, a very strong sense that there was far more to us than we were consciously aware of. That our lives, in a sense, were mostly unconscious. And we were mostly unaware of what was motivating us and of what we want. And so he built up over quite a long time, a sort of picture of what it was to be a person in his view. Now, obviously, this is a fiction, it's not a fact, but these are descriptions of what it is to be a person. And this involves, on the one hand, the fact that we were all babies and children for quite a long time, that we are unaware very largely of what's going on in our minds, that we have desires that we feel endangered by, and that there is a sort of a life cycle. Again, he didn't invent this, but that for him, childhood development divided up into stages, and they're quite sensible in a way, and obvious ones. He talks about an oral stage, where children obviously are preoccupied by eating, to begin with sucking and then eating. Then what he called an anal stage, in which children were preoccupied by controlling what goes out of their bodies in relation to their mothers or fathers. And then he referred to what he called a phallic stage, which was a more evidently sexual stage, if you like. And in the middle of this, there was the now famous Oedipus complex. And the Oedipus complex, again, this is simple. All the best Freudian ideas are actually very simple. The Oedipus complex he saw as being about the fact that every child has two parents. Now, the one parent might be absent, but they have had two parents in order to exist at all. And that a child always has a desire, in his view, for the parent of the opposite sex, and a wish to get rid of the parent of the same sex. In other words, we start in a situation of intense rivalry. Now, Freud will say that we desire both our fathers and our mothers, and when we desire them, and desire means craving their company, longing to have exclusive possession of them. And so that makes the other parent, the left-out parent, a rival. And this elicits strong aggressive wishes. But also, the child has the experience of being left out of the couple that are the parents. So the parents, let's say, hopefully, adore this child, but every night they go to bed together and the child's in their own bedroom. So, of course, this is very powerful for everybody involved. So one of our initial experiences is of being left out and a feeling that other people are having more pleasure than we are. Freud sees development as sort of in two stages, or three stages indeed. There's an initial period of sort of vaguely 0 to 5, in which one is like a bundle of desires and appetites. Then there's what he calls a latency period, when these appetites, in their rawness and their immediacy, go a bit underground. And then, of course, everything recurs and revives in puberty. So it's what he calls a diphasic process of sexual development. There's 0 to 5, and then there's a deferment, and then in puberty, sexuality as we know it begins to turn up.
So during adolescence then, the stage when you're a sort of teenager and you're starting to gain your independence, is that a stage at which you're trying to move outside of family relations?
Yes, that it's a very powerful moment or period in a child's life when they notice there are pleasures outside the family. And of course, it puts you as a child in a bind, because if you go outside the family for your pleasures, you could be both betraying the family, abandoning the family, you could feel abandoned yourself. Well, obviously in puberty, everybody realises in different forms, I mean, I don't know who we're talking about here, but let's say lots of people, that sex is the route out of the family. And that's when sexuality turns up, effectively, as an abiding preoccupation. So obviously the one thing you can't get from your parents is sexual satisfaction. And that's like the prompt or the inspiration for leaving the family circle. But of course it's fraught with anxieties and conflicts. It's not for anybody straightforward. And so in a way what Freud says is life is fundamentally conflictual. And when there's someone we desire, or an object of desire, we're always very ambivalent about them. We love them and we hate them.
Part of Freud's like big idea here is that these conflicting feelings we might have aren't necessarily ones that are transparent to us or that are known to us. And you mentioned the idea of the unconscious. Could you tell us a bit more about that idea, the sort of darker drives and desires?
Well, one of the problems with the so-called unconscious is picturing it. Because, of course, you could picture it as an archive of memories and desires. You could picture it as a sort of museum. Of course, these are all verbal analogies. You can't see the unconscious. It isn't like that. So you might think of the unconscious as what about yourself is as yet unknown, what you are so far unaware of. And you have, obviously, an infinite potential of unknownness. And on the one hand, this is biologically based, as in we have certain drives or fundamental instincts. And, of course, we have memories. And by definition, we can't know what's in the unconscious. We've got ideas to do with instinctual life and so on. But the point about the unconscious is it's unpredictable. If you think of how many minutes of our childhood we've lived through, well, one of the questions for Freud is, well, what's registered? What's remembered? And in what form is it remembered? And why is it remembered? And why do you remember it when you remember it? In other words, it may have something to do with your present or your ideas about your future.
And so is Freud's suggestion about the philosophers and the poets discovering the unconscious before him, can that help us here? What does Freud mean when he's saying that the poets and the philosophers have discovered the unconscious?
Well, I think what he's saying is that he can find and hear echoes of his work in previous writers. And of course, writing is partly about the unknown. People are writing things that they are through which they are discovering things. And they're writing things they didn't plan to write. So when Freud says this, it's an acknowledgement that, well, first of all, psychoanalysis doesn't come from nowhere. That, you know, everybody writes the books they write because of the books they've read. Well, Freud had read all sorts of books and obviously was very interested in literature. And so clearly he found what could easily be taken to be not the origins of psychoanalysis, but the tradition in which psychoanalysis was writing. As in, for example, the 19th century novel, Greek tragedies, lots of, and Goethe's Faust. And there are lots of bits and pieces of literature that clearly informed Freud's discoveries of psychoanalysis. And it's largely to do with what is called, in a rather glamorising way, the dark side of human nature. In other words, the parts of ourselves that we are excited and frightened by.
Would romanticism be part of this?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in a way, what we now think of as psychoanalysis began with romanticism. In other words, the sense that there was much more to us than we knew about and that religion didn't entirely explain it.
For Freud to be drawing on literature and philosophers as a doctor and as a sort of medical professional, that's quite unusual, isn't it? I'm thinking about more modern day approaches to psychiatry or to mental health. Often literature and philosophy aren't the sources that they draw on. So was this controversial?
I think it was. And if it was Freud, it was controversial even for Freud himself. There's an interesting moment, and he wrote a book called Studies in Hysteria with a colleague called Joseph Breuer. And there's a moment in that where Freud says a word to the effect of, these case histories sound like short stories. And you can see he's troubled by this, because if they're like short stories, they don't have the prestige of science. And yet, of course, if they're like short stories, they're in a different kind of tradition. And it's clear to Freud that he's writing something that is equivalent to fictions about relationships between people.
And do you think he's challenging the ideas that literature and philosophy are just in the realm of stories or ideas, and then you've got science on the other side, which is the realm of facts?
I think so. I think that he never puts it quite like this, but it's sort of clear and implicit that psychoanalysis and philosophy and literature are made with words. They are, in a certain sense, entirely linguistic phenomena. So if we're going to understand what's going on, we have to understand something about language. But the implication is that that's what we're doing. We're making up fictions. Now, we might have different criteria about what makes them true, And for in hard science, it would be empirical verification. We can observe this, we can see it, we can hear it, we can, etc. Psychoanalysis, even though Freud wanted it to be a science, is not a science. It's extremely impressionistic.
The importance of language is borne out in the image of the talking cure, which is often used to describe the Freudian approach to therapy. Is that a useful phrase?
It's a very useful phrase. It was used by one of Freud's patients about psychoanalysis. The problem with the phrase is the word cure, because it's not clear, and it has always been controversial, A, whether psychoanalysis does cure, and B, what concept of cure psychoanalysis can reasonably believe in. But what is important about it is that nothing is exchanged between the psychoanalyst and the patient other than words and money. But the medium of the treatment is entirely in words. It's a conversation, but of a very unusual kind, because the analyst is relatively unforthcoming. The analyst is, to differing degrees and at different times, more silent than a normal conversational partner. The onus is on the patient to speak. And the analyst is listening for whatever it is the patient is saying that he or she doesn't notice that they're saying, and noticing and pointing out what they're unwilling or unable to say. So one of the things you do as an analyst is you point out where the patient falters or stumbles or makes famously a Freudian slip. In a Freudian slip, somebody says something other than they intended to say. It doesn't mean what they've now said is the true version. It means that there are at least two versions in play. So the analyst is listening out for ambiguities in language, puns, unintended suggestions and consequences, and also incoherence. So, of course, one of the things famously analysts are interested in are dreams. And dreams, of course, are not initially in the form of language. Weirdly enough, they're visual, but we see them without our eyes. But the only access we have to the dream is the dream report in words. And Freud is effectively saying, if you want to understand something about how the unconscious works, because it's a different kind of mental functioning than consciousness, it's wildly irrational. That means it doesn't abide by the rules and the criteria of conscious language and thought. So in the unconscious, if we think of it as a form of thinking, Freud says there are no contradictions. What this means is we can have entirely, happily contradictory thoughts. So there's a completely different kind of logic. And also there's a logic of illusion as opposed to accuracy. All sorts of things are referred to unwittingly. So that if you tell me a dream, I might pick out a word in your account of your dream and just say to you, what do you associate to that word? And in doing that, all sorts of things may or may not occur. So, for example, if you go to a lecture, consciously, you may, pick up all sorts of things from the lecture in terms of the content of it and what's interesting to you about it or not. You might dream that night about the lecturer's glasses. And if you then go to your analyst and report this dream, you will realise that actually in that lecture you were having all sorts of thoughts of which you were unaware. And so your associations to the lecturer's glasses may be infinitely more revealing than the lecture was. So it's like saying, we've got two agendas. We've got a conscious agenda in which we sort of know what we want and know what we're interested in, etc. But then there's an unconscious agenda. There's another part of ourselves that really is very, very interested in all sorts of things we are not aware of being interested in, that is noticing things we're not aware of ourselves noticing.
Is it the tension then between what we are aware of and what we're not aware of that causes people to have certain neuroses or...
Yes, exactly. It's the conflict between conscious and unconscious wishes. And it's as though the symptom is an attempt to cure the conflict.
And so the idea of psychoanalysis would be that if you talk to somebody, you will be able to work out where these resistances or where these conflicts are happening?
Yes, well, or unhappily. But also you'll be more aware of the desires and interests and wishes and feelings you have that you're unwilling to allow yourself. So what will be revealed to you, if it works, is really the complexity and the contradictoriness of your own mind. There's far more to you than you are aware of.
And this makes me think of the idea in Wittgenstein that a picture can hold us captive, in that not being aware of that complexity, we're sort of fixating on a certain image or idea of how something must be. And do you think that can be, for some people, what gets them into certain problematic ways of thinking about things, that they are fixated on a certain image or a certain narrative, and it's more about opening up the complexity of...
Yes, it's very much that, because it's as though one of the things that sort of psychoanalysis suggests is there's a project to narrow one's mind. And the project of narrowing one's mind is to exclude all the things that are more troubling and or exciting. It's not only that painful things are excluded, pleasurable things are too. Because one of the interesting things Freud and some of his followers say is that pleasure is as much of a problem as pain for a lot of people. But there's a, because of an anxiety about the complexity of one's own mind, one is always seduced into narrowing it. So, for example, you might have a hobby or an interest. Now, you might think, and it'd be perfectly true, that I'm really interested in chess. But two things could be true. I'm really interested in chess, but I'm also using an interest in chess to exclude a lot of other desires I have, which are more difficult for me or more troubling.
What's the status of the analysts? Are they somebody who can show you where your conflicts are arising?
One of the things that happens in psychoanalysis when it works is that the patient assumes that the analyst knows things. This is taken to be a projection of what the patient knows but doesn't want to know. As an analyst, it seems to me you're, it's not a role because that makes it sound too theatrical, but the position you take up is somebody who's facilitating a person's speaking with a view to people being able to hear what it is they say. And so it might be pointing things out. I might reconstruct bits of their childhood. I might interpret a dream. But ideally, it's collaborative. So I want to create the conditions in which people can be self-interpreting as well as get something from me. But they're not coming to see a guru, if you see what I mean. They're not coming to see somebody who actually knows what's going on and what's best for them. It's much more about enabling them to find out what they think is best for them.
So the sort of medium is language and expression. Our words are really crucial to how we kind of go about addressing our problems and our neuroses.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about neuroses, we're fundamentally talking about inhibitions. That we're, in a way, talking about all the ways people have, all of us have, of inhibiting our own desires. That means both inhibiting their expression in language and also inhibiting our enacting them. So it's as though, at its best, what psychoanalysis does is it shows you the nature of your desire, and then it's sort of up to you. It's not that it says, these are your desires, go and enact them. It just says, it looks as though this is what you're desiring. So you have to make some choices in relation to these desires. Some of them may endanger you too much. Some of them may make you feel too ashamed. Some of them may make you feel very frightened, etc. But you need to know. But it's not all about knowing. That's the other thing. It's also about experiencing. It's not simply about knowing what your feelings are, but being able to feel them. So it's a bit like, it's as important to be able to experience a dream as it is to understand it.
In terms of the meaning of cure within psychoanalysis, Freud said that he told his patients that he would have succeeded if he'd transformed their hysterical
misery into ordinary human unhappiness.
So to some people that might sound like it's a bit of a depressing thing to say.
I think it is depressing because it's a rather grim view of human nature. I don't mean we should have an upbeat view, but I mean there are lots of different views. I think the question always is, when you're talking about cure, you're talking about your ideas about what a good life is for somebody. And so the question is, where do you get your ideas about a good life from? Both who do they come from and where do they come from? And also, in the middle of all these, because we're living in a supermarket of good ideas about how to live, how do you work out what you think is a good life? So one of the things you would do in the kind of psychoanalysis that I value is work out for yourself what you think a good life would be for yourself. Because the only question is, how can I get the life I want? And if I can't, or where I can't, what am I going to do?
And would that good life necessarily involve some kind of struggle? Or
certainly in a psychoanalytic, but not only a psychoanalytic view, it would be taken for granted that whatever else life is, it's always a struggle and there's always suffering in it. It doesn't mean there aren't lots of great pleasures in it, but it's going to involve conflict and difficulty.
Is it a bit like the Samuel Beckett line in Endgame that you're on Earth, there's no cure for that?
Yeah, it's exactly like that.
But it seems to me it's to do with thinking of the good life in light of a sort of affirmative conception of the human condition.
Yeah.
And the problems that will necessarily come.
Yes, and you can see how it's a drawback, thinking that we're basically living in a hospital and we're all ill. It's a very odd picture of human beings and human life. Because one of the things that psychoanalysis is against, so to speak, is religion. In other words, this is an entirely secular therapy. So if you aren't religious, if you believe, as they used to say, that God is dead, then that means that there's nobody who really understands us anymore, except each other. And that means that it's up to us to make it up between us. And in a way, what psychoanalysis, I think, is part of is saying, well, if there's no God, what are we supposed to do together? You know, if this is the 14th century, we walked outside into the street and said, what do you want? Everybody would say they wanted to be saved. Well, now everyone might say they want to be rich or they want to be famous or whatever. Psychoanalysis is a place where you can work out what it is you want. and if there's anything you want. Do you feel your life's worth living?
What do you think about stuff that we hear about mental health in young people? Big surveys that are saying that there's 1 in 5 young people suffering from anxiety, depression, that idea that there's a mental health crisis amongst young people today.
Well, I can't speak statistically, and obviously I don't know who we're talking about, but I do think it's a good thing when it is flagged up and made public that a lot of young people are actually suffering. I don't myself believe in something called mental health or mental illness. I think people have difficulties in living, if you see what I mean. So I don't think we need more doctors, but I do think there should be available to people who want it psychotherapy or counselling. And what that means is somebody who is genuinely willing and able to listen. Not people who think they know what people should be doing or want to tell people how to behave or who want to fix people, but people who are actually genuinely wanting to listen and let somebody speak their distress in as thorough and elaborate a way as they can. Because actually psychoanalysis is a listening cure more than a talking cure. But being listened to is very, very powerful.
If we think of the self-help literature that's out there around things like anxiety, I was just Googling the other day about what to do if you're feeling anxious, and some of the tips were like go for a walk or things like that, and talking to someone was on there as well. But it just struck me that actually that's not always that easy to do, is it, to just talk to someone and tell them how you feel. It's sort of a certain type of conversation or a certain kind of conditions that need to be put in place.
Yes, and people are very frightened of each other, and why they are is not obvious, but they are. I mean, I do think that it's good to live in a culture where lots of people, there's lots of advice around, if you see what I mean. And people have to try things out. You know, people have to try things, if they have the money and the affluence or the class advantages, they have to find out what's available. But as you say, it's very difficult to find good conversations. So you could think, at least for some people, really one of their life projects is find the conversations that will help them get the life they want. And one might have to do a lot of experimenting to do that.
Do you think it's something that can happen outside of analysis then?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think psychoanalysis is one version of this. But I think people should take risks conversationally. They should, it isn't the right word, but they should test their conversational partners. Because if somebody is not able to listen and be interested and respond sympathetically, then they are really no use to you.
So it's about having people you can maybe give something you've said back to you in a... Yeah. In a new form or a new way of thinking about something. There's moves at the moment to start introducing mental health lessons into the school curriculum. What do you think about that idea of introducing a lesson a week in mental health?
I think it's a really good idea, depending on how it's done. I think it's very good to help people find a language for the things that trouble them or interest them or all that. I also think it's very important that there's an alternative provided to drug culture. See, if you're very unhappy and you go to a doctor, you could easily feel fobbed off with a drug, as though the doctor's saying to you, look, I don't really want to hear too much about this. Take this drug and you'll feel better. Well, a lot of things that people suffer from are very, very important. When you're suffering, you're telling yourself something you need to know about. It's not that the machine has gone wrong. It's that the person is registering something. So I would like, and I could imagine sort of doing this, a curriculum, so to speak, that showed children of different ages in appropriate ways, ways of thinking about and talking about a range of very familiar human problems to do with fear, misery, unhappiness, worrying about parents, worrying about sexuality, what sexuality is or might be, because it's very unclear that. And also helping children with, especially adolescents, not using sexual solutions to non-sexual problems. I mean, there's a whole range of things one might talk about. I think one could also have lessons on frustration, what it feels like, what you do with it, why you have it, etc. So that lots of things would be not normalised, but they'd be a bit de-traumatised. So you haven't got something called depression. Depression is what one comes up with when there are unbearable conflicts in one's life, or when one can't stand one's aliveness. There's something about feeling fully alive that feels dangerous, etc. And there are lots of, you could talk about lots of things in this way. And I think that it might interest quite a lot of children.
Mm. Young people who are having certain problems, they're given a particular label and then kind of assimilate that. So I've got anxiety.
Well, one of the things I would want to teach in my ideal course is to be against diagnosis, is to be very, very suspicious of diagnosis and very suspicious of authoritative descriptions of who one is or what one's got, because I think you lose too much if that's your approach, if you see what I mean. I think you need, because one thing very striking to me always was how many very different kinds of children, different, you know, races, religions, classes, etc., could use psychotherapy. And really all that means is enabling people to be interested in themselves in ways that they enjoy and is productive.
But not to kind of come with a sense that I've got this condition and I need to get rid of it.
Yes, exactly. We're not trying to get rid of things, we're trying to make sense of them. It's a very different approach. And the implication is that your symptom has a meaning. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's not that something's gone wrong, it's something's gone right. You've made a symptom. It's like making a work of art. You've made a symptom to express something that really matters, but often you don't know what it is and you need a conversation to help you translate it.
What do you think about the kind of CBT approach? Because that's quite a popular one in schools at the moment. So teaching students to sort of identify a negative thought and then replace it with a more positive thought.
Yes, I don't. It's not my cup of tea. I mean, I think, you know, all therapies are interesting, you see what I mean, and interesting to different people. My suspicion about CBT is, A, it's very economically satisfactory to people who don't want to actually invest in mental health, because of course it's quick, relatively speaking. It also treats a person as a sort of self-writing machine, so to speak. And I think people are just much more interesting than CBT suggests they are. And some people find it very useful.
But it could be more short-term type solutions for, sure. For some people, I think, yeah. Isn't it? It tends to have results.
Yeah.
Instantly, but then after a few months, you're back again.
It's a very obvious capitalist commodity therapy, because it's quick, it's supposedly efficient, and it makes your life better, as though those are the projects. Well, there could be a lot of other projects.
It seems to fit quite well with the ideology that's standing over education at the moment, which is business, economic.
Yeah, as though the project is really to make people more efficient.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, to make the whole thing profitable.
Yeah.
And I think once neoliberalism, our version of capitalism, takes over, then people are going to be treated as though they are there to be made money out of or to make money. They're fundamentally consumers. The question is, how can you be a better consumer? As opposed to the question, how can you be a better person?
And this is very different then to the psychoanalytic session.
The psychoanalyst doesn't have that kind of project in relation to you. The psychoanalyst wants to enable you to speak and feel.
You've written about the way that psychoanalysis could be related to a poetry lesson or and a poetry lesson like psychoanalysis. So I wondered if would there be an opportunity in lessons like literature and...
Yes, I mean, I would have thought, you know, we were talking a minute ago about lessons in mental health. Well, lessons in literature and philosophy and poetry are lessons in so-called mental health. In other words, they're about people expressing their profoundest predicaments. They're about people finding the language for what they're really preoccupied by. And that can only be a good thing. For the people who like it. I mean, it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Even subjects like literature, etc., are kind of assimilated into that model of education where it's more about learning the objectives.
So. Yeah, exactly. And the kind of education I would favour wouldn't know what its objectives were, if you see what I mean, that they would be made up in the process of doing what you're doing. So you wouldn't be, for example, reading a poem to get the meaning of it. You'd be reading a poem to see where reading a poem gets you.
And do you think education in that sense would be like the psychoanalytic session?
Yeah, I mean, I think education is the best thing going, really. Freud has an interesting phrase where he talks about psychoanalysis as what he calls an after-education. So it's like having to re-educate yourself. But the implication, of course, that was what one was once educated, which one was. Because, of course, we've been taught to be people. And school is a world outside the family. And it has a very powerful effect on us. It's where we make friends and where we learn things if we're interested in them, or where we pretend to learn things. In other words, it's where we grow up. And so I think, I mean, if I had to choose, I'd always have education over therapy, if you see what I mean. And we can have both. And there are things that psychoanalysis that could be very useful in education.
Like that model of talking and
discussing. And conversation. It's like promoting a certain kind of conversation.
Where you're not trying to get to a certain point,
yes,
but you're just
yes,
exploring.
You don't know what the aim is, but you know the conversation itself is interesting to you. See, I think that it's better to work on the principle that there's actually nothing wrong with anybody, that everybody's doing the best they can with what they've got. And one of the things they've got, if they're lucky, is education. So that education in that sense, which is not about diagnosing you, and it shouldn't be about people discovering whether they're supposedly intelligent or stupid, is a place where people can begin to experiment with the kind of conversations they want. And also, they can find out what does genuinely interest them. I mean, no one's interested in 8 GCSEs. They can't be. But they could be interested in 3. In other words, you find the things that really do get you going, that make you feel alive, and you find the teachers who make you feel alive. And those are formative experiences.
Yeah, because very often the teachers will draw you towards the subject. As students, the teachers that we remember are the ones that teach in the way that they wanted, right?
And actually engaged you, and they made you feel this was really the most interesting thing on earth. You know, the aim of psychoanalysis could be described as finding what you're really absorbed by, what really makes you feel alive, what's really enjoyable to you. So is education.
Going back to where we started the podcast with Freud and the title of Disquieted Life, would the disquieted life be something that for Freud we are trying to get beyond? Or
I think Freud would take it for granted that lives are disquieted, that if you're awake and alive, you will be disquieted. But that in and of itself may not be a bad thing, because it could be a form of being actually alert and aware of the suffering of other people and oneself. It could be about being alert to things that are pleasurable. It could be about being awake. If you're awake, you will be disquieted. But I think it's a misleading ambition or ideal to be sort of serene or in a state of harmony. Or these seem to me to be false pictures, if you like. That it should be, and again, this would be something that education could help people with, which would be to show people why one of the things a good life is, it's a disquieted life. A life that is sensitive to injustice and to the suffering of other people and to oneself. So we really should be disquieted.
And this is why the very idea of mental health is problematic, because it's that sense that of mental health seems to suggest a serene or ideal state.
Yes, exactly. It's the wrong analogy. I mean, if somebody's got a broken leg, more or less everybody agrees it needs to be splinted. If somebody's got a broken heart, there's no consensus.
Not like a physical health.
No, it's not a pill for a headache. And medicine is not a good model for so-called mental health, because there isn't something really called mental health, that people are more or less unhappy, more or less troubled, more or less feel that their lives are not their own.
So, a nice place to leave it.
Good.
Thanks very much, Adam.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to know more about the ideas we've discussed, please check out the show notes on the podcast website. Join us again next time for more discussion of philosophy and the disquieted life.